Time for part 14 of the Vatican Centuries, in which we continue our journey back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. While last week we looked at how the connection between the papacy and the Frankish monarchy was forged, a connection which was to affect papal history decisively and give it the authority to play a significant role in the future history of Europe, we now reach the 8th century and the new empire. But to discover more, stay tuned for the next in this series, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The 8th century had entered its last quarter. Of the five powers who controlled the world, two were in sharp decline, Byzantium and the Lombards.
A third, the papacy, was still fragile in actual power, though growing rapidly in authority and prestige. The forces of Islam had been temporarily halted, but the fear of a Saracen invasion was ever present.
The fifth power, which reached its zenith at this time, was personified by a man whom a contemporary poet indicated as the lighthouse of Europe. In our own time, he has been described as the greatest instrument for government and conquest since Julius Caesar.
We know him as Charlemagne.
At the turn of the century, the alliance between the papacy and the Frankish monarchy was sealed by the spectacular coronation of Charlemagne by the Pope after Christmas Mass in the Basilica of St. Peter's. It was the inevitable climax to the sequence of events which had begun half a century earlier on a cold January morning over 1,000 miles north of Rome.
On that occasion, Pope Stephen II, on bended knee, appealed to King Pippin for protection. Neither of the two protagonists realized at the time the significance of their historic meeting. For on that day, the pontifical state was born. The temporal power of the papacy came into being. It was to last well over 1,000 years.
On that Epiphany morning in 754, a 12-year-old boy watched the scene, fascinated. He was Charles, Pippin's elder son, soon to pass from the role of spectator to that of leading man.
Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, lived from about 742 to 814 and is generally recognized as the greatest monarch of the Middle Ages. The kingdom of the Franks, which he inherited, stretched from the Pyrenees to the Rhine, from the Mediterranean to the North Sea. Charles, who was a brilliant soldier and an able politician, nearly doubled this kingdom, uniting in one super-state practically the whole of Western Europe. He encouraged learning, championed Christianity, and founded what later came to be known as the Holy Roman Empire.
The achievement of Charlemagne in making it a spiritual as well as an institutional unit gained him the title of King Father of Europe. At the end of World War II, when men were talking of a united Christian Western Europe, Charlemagne's model was invoked, and a Charles the Great Prize was instituted to be awarded for outstanding service to the cause of European unity.
Charles was a tireless worker, rising early and only interrupting his intense political activity to hunt or swim. At table he sat with his wife and children and enjoyed listening to music and a reading from his favourite book, St. Augustine's City of God.
Charles himself was not a cultured man. He barely knew how to write his name. But he was an enlightened ruler and saw the prime necessity of education. His chief advisor in this was Alcuin, the Anglo-Saxon monk and scholar whom he invited to direct his palace school and whom he grew to love as a father. Charles, we are told, sat at Alcuin's feet, learned Latin from him, spoke and prayed in it, read Greek but couldn't pronounce it, slept with tablets and pencils under his pillow, yet never quite mastered the art of writing.
It is said that Charlemagne never uttered an angry word, but he had no time for the lazy or for the willfully ignorant. Once, when he was inspecting a school, he noticed that the sons of poor men studied with greater profit than those of the rich or the nobility. He praised the former and reproved the latter, ending his speech with these words:
"Let none of you, not even if he is the son of a count, expect jobs or honours from me when he is taller. because I shall give nothing to anyone who has not deserved it.
Charles also had ideas about the duties of those who are dedicated to the service of God.
It seems to us, he wrote on one occasion, of sovereign usefulness that bishoprics and monasteries, the government of which Christ has desired to entrust to me, should not content themselves with leading a regular, pious life, but that they should also fulfil the function of teaching. Without a doubt, it is preferable to act well than to know a lot, but it is necessary to know in order to do well.
Charles had a very strong sense of the sacred nature of his mission, which, he declared to Leo III, was to strengthen the Church in the knowledge of the Catholic faith. He was sincerely religious, and on the four different occasions when he visited Rome, he made pilgrimages to all the important churches and took part in the principal ceremonies of Easter and Christmas.
Like his father, Pippin, Charles undertook to protect Rome and the Pope against their enemies, and he kept his commitment faithfully. He made the interdependence of church and state a reality after the divisions and hostility which had existed under Byzantine rule.
A lifelong friend of Pope Hadrian I, Charles was grief-stricken at his death in 795. He had an epigraph specially composed by Alcuin and engraved on a tablet of black marble. The Latin inscription can still be seen, set high up in the wall, to the left of the main entrance of St. Peter's. Alcuin interpreted Charles's sorrow in these words.
I, Charles, wrote these verses in tears for your death, O Hadrian. You were for me a great, a sweet bond of affection, a revered father. And now I wish that here our names may be joined together forever. Hadrian and Charles, I king and you father.
Hadrian's successor, Leo III, sent Charles the keys of St. Peter's tomb and confirmed him as protector and defender of Rome. 5 years later, on Christmas night in the year 800, Charlemagne knelt in St. Peter's Basilica. The Pope placed a crown on the head of the Frankish king, while the crowd in St. Peter's acclaimed him as Emperor of the West. The new empire was born.
When Leo informed Charles of his election to the papacy, he requested the king to send a representative to receive the oath of loyalty from the Roman people. Charles sent the lay abbot Angilbert, laden with gifts, and with the mission of consolidating the relationship between himself and the church and the city of Rome. His letter has been preserved.
We have charged Angilbert to carry out all we deemed desirable for us and necessary for you, so that both of you by mutual agreement may establish whatever you consider necessary for the exaltation of the Holy Church of God, or for your honor, or for the consolidation of our protectorate. With the help of divine charity, it will be our task to defend the Holy Church of Christ from without, taking up arms against pagans and infidels, and to protect it within by the preservation of the Catholic faith. Your task, Holy Father, will be to act as guardian to our cavalry by raising your hands to heaven, like Moses, so that through your intercession and with his leadership, Christianity may, everywhere and always, achieve victory over the enemies of its holy name, and so that the name of our Lord may be glorified throughout the whole world.
You were listening there to part 14 of The Vatican Centuries, a series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.